Mother purses her lips. Has this worked for other people?
Dr. Pohl showed us page after page of testimonials from people he cured, Al says.
Katie,
Papa says intently, putting his hand on Mother's.
This could be the remedy.
She nods slowly but doesn't say anything more. How much money is it exactly? I ask.
It's reasonable,
Papa says. How much? Al looks at me steadily.
Papa hasn't had hope for a long time.
So what does it cost?
Just because nothing worked for you, Christy.
I can't understand why we have to buy apples when we have a perfectly good orchard full of them.
This doctor is an expert. Papa could be cured. You don't want that?
I once read a story about a man named Ivan Illich, who believes he has lived justly and is outraged to discover that he must suffer a horrible fate, an early death of unknown cause. My father is like this. He is furious that he has become a cripple. He has always believed that industry and cleanliness equal moral rectitude, and that moral rectitude should be rewarded. So I'm not surprised that he is so eager to believe this preposterous story about a cure. Papa signs the contract and pays for 30 sessions over 30 weeks, the minimum required. Every Tuesday, Al helps him into the passenger seat of the Model T and drives to Rockland. At each appointment, which as far as I can tell, consists merely of paying more money for mysterious tablets and cataloging his intake of those expensive apples, a divot is punched in his contract. Papa has always run the farm with a firm hand, selling blueberries and vegetables, milk and butter, chickens and eggs, cutting ice and managing the fishing weir for extra money. He's always stressed the importance of saving. But now he seems willing to spend whatever this doctor tells him to in the hopes of getting well. One Tuesday morning, about 4 months into the treatment, only an hour after Al and Papa have left for the weekly trip to Rockland, I hear a car door slam and look out the kitchen window. They're back. Al has a grim look on his face as he helps Papa get out of the car. After taking him upstairs to his room, Al comes into the kitchen and sits down heavily.
Oh, Lord, he says.
What happened?
It was all a ruse.
He rubs his hand through his hair.
When we got to Pohl's office, the whole building was shuttered. A few days ago, they told us, he was chased out of town by angry patients. A lot of people lost their shirts.
Over the next few months, the severity of our situation becomes starkly clear. Papa's $2,000 in savings are gone. We can't pay our bills. More infirm than ever, Papa is listless and depressed and spends all his time upstairs. I try to be sympathetic, but it's hard. Apples. The fruit that tempted Eve lured my poor, gullible father, both seduced by a sweet-talking snake. It's a chilly Thursday morning in October when Papa asks Al to carry his wheelchair down to the shell room. An hour later, a sleek four-door maroon Chrysler glides up to the house, and a woman in a trim gray suit steps out of the back. The driver stays in the car. Hearing a knock on the front door, I make a move to answer it, but Papa says gruffly,
"I'll handle it."
From the back hallway, I can hear some of their conversation. Generous offer. Wealthy man. Desirable shorefront. Doesn't come twice. After the woman leaves, "I'll let myself out," she says and does. I watch out the window as she ducks into the back seat of the Chrysler and taps the driver on the shoulder. Papa sits in the shell room for a few minutes by himself. Then he wheels awkwardly into the kitchen.
"Where's Alvaro?"
"Milking, I think." What was that all about?
"Fetch him. And your mother."
When I'm back from the barn, Papa has wheeled himself into the dining room. Mother, who spends most of her time upstairs, sits at the head of the table, a shawl around her shoulders. Al troops in behind me and stands against the wall, grimy in his overalls.
"That lady brought with her an offer from an industrialist by the name of Sinex," Papa says abruptly. $50,000 for the house and land, cash."
I gape at him.
What?
Al leans forward.
Did you say 50?
I did. 50,000.
That's a hell of a lot of money,
Al says. Papa nods.
It's a hell of a lot of money.
He pauses for a few moments, letting the news sink in. I look around. All three of us are open-mouthed. Then he says,
I hate to say this, but I think it would be wise for us to accept this offer.
John, you can't be serious.
Mother says,
I am serious.
What an absurd idea.
She sits up straight, pulling the shawl tight around her shoulders. Papa raises his hand.
Hold on, Katie. My savings have been spent. This could be a way out.
He shakes his head.
I hate to say it, but our options at this point are few. If we don't take this now,
where would you...
we go?
Al asks. I can tell as he stumbles over the words that he's trying to assess Papa's state of mind, wondering if he and I factor into it at all.
I'd like a smaller house,
Papa says.
And with the money, I could help you set up your own homes.
We are all quiet for a moment, contemplating this. Except for the time with Walton, which seems to me now like a fever dream. Hallucinatory and indistinct. Unrelated to my life before or after. I have lived in this house like a mollusk in its shell, never imagining that I might be separated from it. I've taken for granted my existence here. The worn stairs, the whale oil lamp in the hall, the view of the grass and the cove beyond from the front stoop. Mother rises abruptly from her chair.
This house has been in my family since 1743. Generations of Hawthorns have lived and died here. You don't walk away from a house simply because someone offers to buy it.
50,000!
Papa raps his misshapen knuckles on the table.
We will not see an offer like this again, I can tell you.
She tugs at her dress, her jaw clenched, the veins on her neck like rivulets of water. I have never seen the two of them in conflict like this.
This is my house, not yours, she says fiercely. We will stay on.
Papa's face is grim, but he doesn't speak. Mother is a Hawthorn. He is not. The conversation is over. Papa will spend the next 15 years confined to a wheelchair in a small room on the ground floor of the house he was so eager to sell, rarely venturing outside. Al and I, with the help of our brothers, will scrape and save, learn to live with even less. We'll manage just barely to save the farm from bankruptcy. But sometimes I will wonder, all of us will wonder, whether it would have been better to let it go. In July of 1921, Sam, laughing, gathers our family together in the shell room, clasping the hand of his bespectacled choir leader girlfriend Mary. He announces that he has asked for her hand in marriage.
Of course, I said yes!
Mary beams, holding out her left hand to show us the modest engagement ring she inherited from her grandmother. This news isn't a complete surprise. The two of them met in Malden, where Mary grew up, when Sam stayed to work for Herbert Carl, and have been together for several years. I watch as he moves closer and whispers something, as she blushes and he brushes her hair behind her ear. I'm so happy for you both, I tell them. And though I feel a pang of sadness for myself, witnessing their casual intimacy, I mean it. Dear, kind Sam deserves to find love. Sam and Mary's wedding is held on the lawn, as Mary calls it, though we Olsons have never thought of it as anything but the field. Al and Fred built a pergola and set up 2 rows of 20 chairs borrowed from the Grange Hall. Over several days, I bake rolls, blueberry and strawberry pies, and a wedding cake, Sam's favorite. Lemon with buttercream frosting. Mary wears a lacy dress and veil. Sam is dashing in a dark gray suit.
A three-piece band from Rockland plays on the bluff above the shore, where Fred has organized a clam bake at the water's edge. After their honeymoon, the newlyweds move into our family homestead to save money for a house of their own. I like having another woman around, particularly one as young and friendly as Mary, who is solid and kind and laughs easily. She is good company in the house, helping me cook and clean. Sam and Mary settle into a bedroom on the third floor, away from the rest of the family, and soon enough, Mary is with child. Unlike Ramona, as reported in her letters, she has no morning sickness. We sit by the hearth as she knits blankets and I sew frocks for the baby, talking about the weather and the crop yield and the people we know in common, such as Gertrude Gibbons, who was married recently herself. She sent an invitation to the wedding, but I didn't go. That girl's got some border collie in her blood. Can't help herding and nipping, but she's all right, Mary says. The image makes me smile, both because it's exactly what Gertrude does, and because Mary says it so matter-of-factly, without rancor. I don't mention my waspish comment to Gertrude at the dance. It's hard to feel proud of that. Months later, woken in the middle of the night by a low moan, I lie in the darkness of my bedroom, my breathing the only sound. Sitting up, I strain to listen. Minutes pass. Another moan, louder this time, and then I know. It's time for the baby to be born. I hear Sam's heavy footsteps down two flights of stairs and out the front door. The Ford engine revs. He's on the way to get the midwife. I bend and unbend my legs, as I do every morning, and carefully swing them over the side, holding on to the spindle frame as I reach for my dress on the peg on the back of the door. In the darkness I pull on stockings and lace my feet into shoes, then make my way downstairs, leaning on the banister. Papa is in the foyer in his wheelchair, bumping around, muttering under his breath in Swedish, trying to navigate the doorways to get to the kitchen. He must have roused himself from bed, a task Al usually helps him with. I fill the kettle from the urn of water on the floor, fire up the Glenwood, and take out oats for porridge and bread for toast as the sun rises in the sky. After some time, I see the car pull up in front of the house. The midwife steps out carrying a large tapestry bag. Then the back door opens and Gertrude Gibbons emerges. What is she doing here?
Look who I found, Sam says, stepping into the kitchen. Mary thought it might be useful to have another set of hands.
How are you, Christina?
Gertrude says, just behind him, smiling brightly. I'm fine, Gertrude, I say, trying to keep my voice neutral. We haven't seen each other since that long-ago dance, and it feels stiff and awkward between us.
I know you have difficulty with those stairs, and your mother isn't well, she says. I'm honored to fill the gap. Where is dear Mary?
When everyone has trooped upstairs, I step out into the cool air of the backyard, shadowed at this early hour by the house. Al has been plowing the garden plot, and the dirt smells fresh and damp from yesterday's rain. Tessie neighs in a distant field. Lolly whines between my legs, pressing against my calves. Sinking onto the stone step, I pull her into my lap, but she yowls and slinks away. I feel low, heavy, weighted to the earth. Earlier in the spring, a birth announcement arrived from Ramona and Harland. A girl named Rose, 7 pounds 9 ounces. In June, Eloise married Bill Rivers, and Alva eloped with Eva Schumann a few weeks later. I'm glad for Sam and Mary, for all of them, but every ritual—weddings, births, christenings—reminds me of how alone I am. My own life so barren in contrast. Tears well in my eyes.
Why, there you are!
Glancing over my shoulder, I see Gertrude's face crosshatched in the screen.
I've been looking for you all over. The midwife doesn't need me at the moment. She says Mary is a natural.
I wipe my face with the back of my hand,
hoping she didn't see, but nothing gets past Gertrude.
What on earth is wrong? Are you hurt?
No. She tries to open the screen, but I'm sitting in the way.
Did something happen?
No.
Can I come out there?
The last thing I want to do is explain my tears to Gertrude Gibbons. She is here out of curiosity, after all, and boredom, and her endless desire to know what's going on.
Please, just give me a minute.
But she will not.
Mercy, Christina, if...
I said, I tell her, my voice rising, leave me alone.
Well...
Affronted, she pauses. Then she says coldly, I was coming down to help with breakfast, but I see you have let the fire go out. I stand up unsteadily. Then I yank open the door, startling her, tears clouding my vision. I lurch into the kitchen. My awkwardness irritates me even further. Everything is a blur, and Gertrude is looking at me in her usual obtuse, judgmental, pitying way. I hate her for it, for seeing me clearly, for not seeing me at all. I careen through the pantry, forcing her to step back against the wall. I want to be upstairs in my bedroom, with the door shut. But how can I navigate the stairs without her watching? And then I realize I don't care. I just need to get there. Leaning against the wall, I pull myself along the hallway until I reach them. I use my forearms and elbows to hoist myself up the narrow stairs, stopping to rest every few steps, knowing that Gertrude is listening to every grunt. When I reach the landing at the top, I look down. There she is, standing in the foyer with her hands on her hips.
Honestly, Christina, I do not under...
But I won't listen. I can't. Turning away, I wrench myself along the floor to my bedroom, where I kick the door shut behind me. I lie on the floor of my bedroom, breathing heavily. After a few minutes, I hear footsteps plodding up the stairs. Then a rap on the door.
Christina?
Gertrude's voice is laced with affected concern. Scooting backward, I grasp the bedpost, then turn around and heave myself up onto the mattress, trying to slow my pounding heartbeat. Her presence on the other side of the door radiates a nasty heat. I am flushed with it. Another rap. Go away.
For mercy's sake, let me in.
There's no lock. After a moment, I watch the white porcelain knob turn. Gertrude steps into the room and shuts the door, her doughy face pinched with pantomimed worry.
What is wrong with you?
I wish I could dart around her, but my only recourse is words. I did not invite you here.
Well, your brother asked me to come. Honestly, with three of you infirm in this household, I should think you'd be grateful for it. I assure you, I am not.
For a moment, we glare at each other. Then she says,
Now listen. You make breakfast for this family every single day of the year. You need to pull yourself together and prepare some food right this minute. Why are you being so hateful?
I'm not sure I understand it myself, but my flinty anger feels good. Better than sadness. I don't want to let it go. I cross my arms. She sighs.
We are about to welcome this wonderful new life, this baby. I'm sorry to be blunt, but you are acting like a child. Maybe nobody else is saying this to you, but I assure you they're thinking it.
She runs her hands down the bedspread near my leg, smoothing the wrinkles.
Sometimes we all need a good friend to tell us what's what.
I flinch from her hand.
You are not a friend to me, much less a good friend. Why, how can you say that? What do you mean?
I mean that... What do I mean?
You take pleasure in my misfortune. It makes you feel superior.
Her neck reddens. She puts a hand to her throat.
That is a terrible thing to say.
It's how I feel.
I invited you to my wedding, which, let me remind you, you did not attend, nor send a gift.
I feel a little twinge. I'd forgotten about the gift. But I'm in no mood to apologize.
Let's be honest, Gertrude. You didn't want me at your wedding. Do not presume to know what I want or don't want, she says, her voice rising in a hiss. Then she pokes at the ceiling and puts a finger to her lips. Shh! You're the one raising your voice, I say evenly. Christina, this is foolishness, she says, suddenly imperious. No doubt it was devastating for you what happened with that man, Walton Hall. Hearing his name on her lips makes me shudder. But it's time to move on. You have to stop stewing in your misfortune. Don't you wish the best for your brother and Mary? Now let's forget this ever happened and go make some food for those hungry people. Bringing up Walton is the final straw. Get out of my room. She gives a little disbelieving laugh. Why, If you don't leave my room this minute, I swear I will never speak to you again. Now, Christina! I mean it, Gertrude. This is outrageous. In all my days... She looks around as if some unseen presence in the room might come to her aid. I shift on the bed, turning my body away from her. She stands in the middle of the floor for a moment, breathing heavily. You have a very cold heart, Christina Olsen, she says. Then she wrenches open the door and walks out into the hall, slamming it behind her. I hear her hesitate on the landing, then heavy footsteps down the stairs. Muffled voices. She is speaking to Papa in the dining room. The screen door opens with a creak and swings shut.
What promises I make, I keep, Walton once said.
His words were empty, but mine are not. Despite the fact that we live in a small place and are bound to run into each other, I keep my promise to Gertrude Gibbons. I will never speak to her again. By the time my nephew, John William, given his grandfather's American name, is born on the third floor a few hours later, I've made my way downstairs to the pantry, where I wash my face with a cool cloth and tame my hair with a horsehair brush. I coax the fire back to life and lay a table with sliced turkey and pickled beans and fried apple cake. When my brother Sam places the small bundle in my arms, as warm and dense as a loaf of bread fresh from the oven, I look down into the face of this child, John William. He stares up at me intently with dark eyes, his brow furrowed, as if he's trying to figure out who I am, and my melancholy lifts, lightens, evaporates into the air. It's impossible to feel anything for this baby but love. Thornback. 1946 to 1947. Only traces of white remain on the sun-bleached, snow-battered clapboards and shingles of this old house. Inside, wood smoke, fuel oil, and tobacco have darkened the wallpaper. Sometimes it feels as if Al and I are living in a haunted house with the ghosts of our parents, our grandparents, all those sea captains and their wives and children. I still keep the door between the kitchen and the shed open for the witches. Ghosts and witches all around. The thought is oddly comforting. Much of the time these days, the house is quiet. I've come to think of silence as another kind of sound. After all, the world is never totally silent, even in the middle of the night. Beds creak. A wolf howls. Wind stirs the trees. The sea roars and shushes. And, of course, there's plenty to see. In springtime, I watch the deer, noses to the wind, trailed by speckled fawns. In summer, rabbits and raccoons. In autumn, a bull moose loping across the field. A red fox vivid against December snow. Hours accumulate like snow, recede like the tide. Al and I drift through our routines. Get up when we want to. Go to bed when light drains from the sky. Nobody's schedules to attend to other than our own. We hunker down in the fall and winter, slow our heartbeats to a hibernating rhythm,
struggle to rouse ourselves in March. People from away arrive in cars laden with bags and boxes in June and July, and head out in the opposite direction in August and September. 1 year melts into the next. Each season is like it was the year before, with minor variations. Our conversations often revolve around the weather. Will this summer be hotter than last? Can we expect an early frost? How many inches of snow by December? This life of ours can feel an awful lot like waiting. In the summer, I'm usually up before sunrise, lighting the Glenwood Range and making porridge. I rarely sleep through the night on my pallet. My legs throb, even in my dreams. I'll scoop a cup for myself and eat it in the dark, listening to the sounds of the house, the gulls cawing outside. When Al comes into the kitchen, I'll hand him a cup of porridge, and he'll take it to the counter and sprinkle sugar on it from Mother's cut glass bowl.
"Well, I suppose it's milking time,"
he says when he's finished. He carries the cup to the sink in the pantry and dredges water from the pump.
"I can wash that,"
I sometimes protest. "You've got chores." But he always rinses his cup, and my cup too.
"It's no trouble."
When Al heads out to the barn, I sit in my old chair, looking out the window toward the road to town in one direction, and the St. George River, and beyond it the sea in the other. The sun shimmers on the water, and the wind carves patterns in the high grass. Around mid-morning, Andy usually shows up, disappears upstairs, emerges for lunch, leaves in the late afternoon. With the door propped open, Topsy and the cats come and go as they please. Sometimes a friendly porcupine climbs up the steps, waddles across the kitchen, and disappears into the pantry. I might drift to sleep and wake to purring, which sounds to my sleep-clotted brain like a faraway motor. Lolly, seeing my eyes flicker, stretches toward my face, her paws digging into my shoulder. I reach under her ribcage, feeling through her warm skin, the quick thrumming of her heart. Later in the day, I'll weed and prune my flower garden, brilliant with color. Poppies and pansies, and an assortment of sweet peas, pale blue, peach, magenta. Red geraniums grow fat and healthy in the window in their spry shortening cans, and old blue-painted pots. I fill vases with the white lilacs that have grown beside the shed for 100 years, alongside Al's favorite pink roses. The cats sprawl in the sun, blinking lazily. I can't imagine anywhere I'd rather be. But in the winter, when it's so cold in the early morning that you can see your breath as you lie in bed, when getting to the barn requires a hoe to cut through the icy crust on top of the snow, when the wind slices branches off the trees and the sky is as dull as a stone, it's hard to see why anyone would live here if they have a choice. Heating this old house is like heating a lobster trap. The 3 wood stoves must be fed constantly or we will freeze. It takes 11 cords of wood to keep the fires burning until spring. Darkness comes early without electricity. Before turning in, Al banks the stoves high with firewood to keep the embers glowing through the night. I heat bricks in the oven to wrap in towels and slide under the covers. Many nights we are in bed by 8 o'clock, staring at the ceiling in separate rooms. Do our natures dictate the choices we make, I wonder? Or do we choose to live a certain way because of circumstances beyond our control? Perhaps these questions are impossible to tease apart because, like a tangle of seaweed on a rock, they are connected at the root. I think of those long-ago hawthorns, determined beyond all reason to leave the past behind, and we, their descendants, inheritors of their contrarian tenacity, sticking it out, one generation after the next, until every last one of us ends up in the graveyard at the bottom of the field. The postcard, stamped Tokyo, features a scenic view of an arched bridge leading to a mansion with a curved roof. Nijubashi. The main entrance to the Imperial Palace, the caption says in English, on the front, next to a string of Japanese characters. Though it's not unlike the half-dozen postcards I've received in the past few months of 1945, the scrawled message from John on the other side is a surprise.
Finally, Aunt Christina, I'm coming home.
My old friend Sadie Ham also has reason to celebrate. Her son Clyde was injured, but he is coming home with only a flesh wound to his upper arm and some shrapnel in his legs. She's teary when she tells me the news.
It could have been so different for us,
she says,
when I think about what others have to endure.
The postmistress Bertha Dorset's two sons were drafted into the army, and her youngest died in France. And Gertrude Gibbons's nephew, who grew up in Rockland and was trained as a fighter pilot, was killed over the Pacific. I never would have guessed, seeing the soldiers on Boston Common all those years ago, that another world war would engulf us. I couldn't have imagined how much more there was to lose.
You could drop a note to Gertrude, you know, Sadie says gently. I'm sure it would mean a lot to her.
I could, I say. A lot of time has passed.
It has.
But though I feel a pang of sadness for Gertrude, I know I won't reach out. I am too old, too stubborn. Her meddlesome insensitivity was something I could not, cannot, in the end, forgive. And if I'm honest, there's something else. Gertrude has become a stand-in for anyone who ever pitied me, didn't try to understand me, abandoned me. She gives my bitterness a place to dwell. It takes several weeks for John to travel by boat from Japan to Treasure Island in the South Pacific and, from there, by ferry to San Francisco, and another 5 days on a train to Boston, where he is officially discharged from the Navy on Christmas Eve, 1945. He shows up at our house in uniform on Christmas Day with a chest full of medals, colorful packets of pastel-colored hard sugar candies called Conpito that I don't care for, and a newly acquired, un-Olsen-like propensity to hug. John is taller, thinner, and flinty-featured, but still as mild-mannered as ever. I can't wait to pull my lobster boat out of the shed and get out on the water, he tells me. I've missed this place. He doesn't waste any time getting settled. By spring 1946, he's engaged to a local woman named Marjorie Jordan. You'll come to the wedding, won't you, Aunt Christina? He implores, taking my hand. How will I ever get to a wedding when I can barely walk? My land, you don't need me at your wedding.
I most certainly do. You're coming if I have to carry you there myself.
I motion for him to come closer. I don't know what to say, but I want to say something. I'm touched that he wants me there. I'm glad you survived, I tell him when he crouches down beside me. Laughing, he kisses me on the cheek.
I'm glad I survived too. So you'll come?
I'll come. Sadie claps her hands together when I tell her the news.
What fun! All right, then. We need to find you a dress. I'll take you into Rockland.
Not store-bought. I'm going to make it myself. She looks at me doubtfully.
How long has it been since you sewed anything?
A while, I guess. I hold my gnarled hands out, palms up. I know they look frightful, but they work just fine. Sighing, she says, if you insist, I'll take you to get some fabric. The next morning, Sadie helps me into her cream-colored Packard sedan and drives me to Center Crane in Rockland. On the ride, I begin to worry. How is she going to maneuver me inside? When she parks the car, Sadie leans over and pats my knee. As if reading my mind, she says, why don't you let me go in and get you some samples? What would you like? I let out a breath I didn't know I was holding. That's probably best. Maybe a flowered silk? You got it. I watch her whisk through the revolving door. She spins out 10 minutes later with a dress pattern and 3 squares of fabric.
Thanks to rationing, no silk, she says. But I found some decent options. She hands me the squares. A sky blue dotted Swiss, a floral rayon, and light pink cotton broadcloth. I choose the pink, of course. At home in the dining room, I spread the fabric across the table and study the picture on the cover of the pattern. A thin, elegant woman who looks nothing like me, in a dress with a fitted bodice and a long paneled skirt. I take the flimsy folded pattern out of its envelope and lay it over the cloth, find the pincushion in my sewing basket, and attempt to secure it. I'm startled to find that my fingers are shaking badly. Only with laborious effort do I manage to pin a section of the pattern to the cloth. I slice into it with my heavy silver scissors, but the line is jagged. When I open the sewing machine, I sit at it for a few minutes, running my hand over its curves, touching the still sharp needle with my finger. All at once I'm afraid. Afraid I'll ruin the dress. I sit back in my chair. It's not just the dress, or my wretched hands. It's all of it. I'm afraid for my future. A future of inevitable debilitation. Of increasing reliance on others. Of spending the rest of my years in this broken shell of a house. When Sadie stops by a few days later, she runs her finger along the erratic line of the pins, inspects the ragged cut. "You made a start," she says gently. "Shall I take it over to Catherine Bailey in Maple Juice Cove to finish it up?" She doesn't look in my eyes. I can tell she doesn't want to embarrass me. When I nod, she says, "Right then," and carefully folds the pattern with the fabric, gathers the spools of pink thread and the instructions. Unfurling the yellow measuring tape from my sewing box, she encircles my waist, my hips, my bodice, scratches the numbers on a scrap of paper, and tucks it all into a bag. Several weeks later, I'm sitting in the kitchen, wearing my new dress, about to leave for the wedding, when Andy shows up unannounced as usual at the door. Stopping abruptly in the doorway, he says, "My God, Christina!" He strides over and runs his hand down my sleeve, whispering to himself, "Magnificent! Like a faded lobster shell." 1922 to 1938. In the summers now, I make my way to the Grange Hall in Cushing most Fridays. But instead of swaying with the music and chatting with friends as they jostle on and off the dance floor, joking and laughing and carrying on, the bolder ones smoking cigarettes outside and tippling from a flask, I am consigned to the role of fruit punch server, pound cake cutter, molasses cookie arranger. I pick up soiled napkins and wash dirty glasses in the sink behind a partition. Most of the women who play this role are older than I am and married. Only a few are my age. The unchosen and childless. I have not gotten used to it. I'm not sure I ever will. For a while I continue to bring my dress shoes in a bag, as I always have, and put them on as soon as I arrive. But one evening when the hall is particularly hot, I excuse myself from the serving table, go outside, roll my stockings down, slip them off my feet, and put my flat-heeled walking shoes back on. What does it matter? It's a damp Friday in August, and I'm walking to the Grange Hall with Fred and his fiancée Laura, wearing a white dress I finished sewing hours earlier from a new McCall's pattern, when I slip in a rut in the road. I put my hands out to stop my fall, but my arms aren't stable enough to support my weight. I drop heavily into the muck and gravel, tearing my sleeves, scraping my chin.
"Oh!"
Fred shouts, leaping toward me.
"Are you all right?"
My chin drips blood. My wrists throb. I'm face down in the wet, soiled dress it took me weeks to sew. The skirt is bunched up around my hips, my bloomers and misshapen legs exposed. Lifting myself slowly on my elbows, I survey my torn bodice. All at once I am so tired of this, of the constant threat of humiliation and pain, the fear of exposure, of trying to act like I'm normal when I'm not, that I burst into tears. No, I am not all right, I want to say. I am fouled, degraded, ashamed. A burden and an embarrassment. Can you get up? Laura asks kindly, standing over me. She crouches down. Let me help you. I turn my face away.
Doesn't seem to be a break,
Fred murmurs, running his expert farmer's hands over my wrists and ankles.
But you'll have some bruises and swelling, I'm afraid, poor thing.
He tells me to flex my hands. Not the easiest maneuver, even when I'm not in pain. When I grimace, he says,
probably a nasty sprain.
No fun at all, but it could be worse. Laura waits with me while Fred jogs back to the house to get the car. At home, the two of them carry me through the front door and upstairs to my room, where Laura finds my nightgown on a peg, and discreetly helps me undress, and Fred gently washes my face and arms. Once they've shut the door behind them, I burrow into my blankets and turn toward the wall. How did I go from being the maiden in a fairy tale to a wretched old maid so quickly? It happened almost without my realizing it. The transition to spinsterhood. Mamay said that in her day, a woman who had not married by the age of 30 was called a thornback, named after a flat, spiny, prehistoric-looking fish. It's what they called Bridget Bishop, she said. Thornback. That's what I have become. When Mother's health becomes so precarious that she and Papa need separate bedrooms, I offer to give up mine. She's in pain. Her kidney issues are worse. Her legs puffed with fluid. She has started sleeping upright in a parlor chair. I move downstairs, where my bed is a pallet on the dining room floor that I roll up each morning and tuck in the closet. It's not so bad. I'm closer to the kitchen and the privy, secretly relieved not to have to navigate the stairs. In the mornings, I prepare the noon meal and carry it through the narrow pantry to the round oak table in the dining room for Al and Papa and me, making a separate plate for Al to carry upstairs for Mother. Baked or boiled potatoes, green beans, roast chicken or turkey or ham, a stew of beef and carrots and onions and potatoes. Every few days I make bread with the sourdough starter. Watch the bread rise. Punch it down. Watch it rise again. In the summer and fall I can the berries Al rakes from their bushes and the strawberries he grows in the garden for jams and jellies, cakes and pies. We mark the days by the chores that need to be done, the way farm families have always done. Al feeds the hens and horses and pigs, splits wood in the fall, slaughters a pig when the weather turns cold, cuts ice in the winter. I collect eggs from the laying hens, and Al drives me into town to sell them. He times the planting, so that by the 4th of July we'll have new peas, and by September there's a whole field of corn. Gulls lunge for a feast, ravaging the crop. So Al kills a few and hangs them from poles as warning. During haying season in midsummer, I see him from the dining room window in his visored cap, scything the hay by hand with 6 hired men walking abreast, forking the newly mown hay onto the hay rack. They haul the hay to the barn, where a block and tackle hoist lifts it into the mow. Swallows, disrupted from their nests, swoop in and out. In late July and August, blueberry season, Al uses a heavy steel hand rake to harvest the small dark berries from their low bushes. It's grueling work, stooping over those low bushes in the hot sun, dumping the berries into a wooden box to be winnowed and weighed, and all summer the back of his neck is burnt and peeling, his knuckles scraped and scarred, his lower back constantly sore. Aside from the Grange Hall socials, the sewing circle I go to now and then, and the occasional visit with Sadie. I don't see many people. Most of my old friends and acquaintances are busy with their new husbands and new lives. At any rate, I have little in common with most of the girls I went to school with who are married and having children. I can tell when we're together that they are self-conscious talking about their husbands and pregnancies. But this difference only highlights what has always been true. I've never shared either their fluid ease of movement or their quick laughter. My wit, such that it is, has always been more sardonic, stranger, harder to recognize. Now and then I leaf through the small blue volume of Emily Dickinson poems that my teacher, Mrs. Crowley, pressed into my hand. I remember her words to me when I left school. Your mind will be your comfort. It is sometimes. And sometimes it isn't. With no one to talk to about the poems, I have to try to parse the meanings myself. It's frustrating not to be able to discuss them with anybody, but also strangely freeing. The lines can mean anything I want. Much madness is divinest sense. To a discerning eye, much sense. The starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all prevail. Assent. And you are sane. Demur. You're straightway dangerous, and handled with a chain. I imagine Emily sitting at her small desk, her back to the world. She must have seemed very odd to those in her orbit. A little unhinged. Even dangerous, perhaps, asserting, as she does, that it's the people who lead conventional lives who are the mad ones. I wonder about that chain that held her. I wonder if it's the same as mine. My cats, as cats will do, have kittens. Al takes boxes of them into town and gives away as many as he can. But before long I'm feeding a dozen. They swarm underfoot, mewling and jumping and sometimes hissing at one another. Al grouses about it, pushes them off the table with an open palm, kicks at them when they wind around his legs, mutters about solving the problem with a rock-heavy sack in the pond.
It's too many, Christy. We've got to get rid of them.
Oh? And then what? I'll go around talking to an empty house? He chews his lip and goes back out to the barn. Late one evening, I'm lying on my pallet in the dark in the dining room, when I hear a commotion upstairs, directly above me, Mother's bedroom. I sit up quickly, fumble for a candle and match, and make my way to the foyer. Mother? I call. Are you all right? No answer. Al is out with Sam playing cards. Papa is sound asleep in his room. There's not much point in waking him. He's frailer than I am. I haven't been upstairs in months, but I know I have to get there now. I haul myself up the stairs as quickly as I can on my elbows, sweat dampening my neck from the effort. When I reach the top, I pull myself to my feet and grope my way down the hall to Mother's door, push it open. In the moonlight, I see that she is on the floor on her knees, fumbling at the quilt in a kind of panic, trying to claw her way up back onto the bed, her nightgown bunched around her thighs. She turns and gives me a bewildered look. I'm here, Mother. Stumbling forward in the dark, I collapse on the floor beside her. I try to help her up with my hands, my elbows, even my shoulder, but her weight is like a sack of flour, and I can't get any traction. She begins sobbing.
I just want to go to bed.
I know, I say miserably. I feel helpless and angry. At myself for being so feeble. At Al for going out. After a few minutes, her sobbing turns to whimpering, and she rests her head on my lap. I pull her nightgown down over her legs and stroke her hair. Sometime later, 15 minutes, half an hour, the front door opens downstairs.
Al!
I shout.
Christy? Where are you?
Up here! Footsteps pound up the stairs, the door slams open. I see the confusion in Al's eyes as he takes in the sight of Mother collapsed on the floor, me cradling her head in my lap.
What is going on?
She fell off the bed, and I couldn't lift her.
Lord of mercy.
Al comes over and gently hoists Mother up onto the mattress, then pulls the quilt over her and kisses her on the forehead. After he's helped me down the stairs and onto my pallet in the dining room, I say,
"That was terrible. You can't leave me alone with her like that."
"Papa's here.
You know he's no help."
Al is silent for a moment. Then he says,
"I need a life of my own, Christy. It's not too much to ask."
"She could have died."
"Well, she didn't."
"It was hard for me."
"I know," he sighs. "I know."
Several months later, about a week after Thanksgiving, I wake early as usual to stoke the fire in the kitchen and begin the process of making bread. The floorboards above my head creak with the ordinary sounds of Al getting up and dressed and going to Papa's room to check on him, the muffled sounds of Papa's deep bass and Al's higher tenor. I scoop flour into the earthenware bowl and add a sprinkle of salt, my hands going through the motions while my head is free to plan the day. Pickled beets and sliced ham warmed in the oven for the noontime meal. Gingerbread cookies if I have time. A pile of mending. I add a scoop of yeasty starter. A dollop of molasses. Warm water from the saucepan on the range. And start kneading, folding in the flour. Upstairs, Al knocks on Mother's door. Or perhaps I only think I hear it, so accustomed am I to his routine. And then I hear sharply,
"Mother!"
Furniture scrapes along the floor. I feel it before I know it. I look up at the ceiling with my hands in the dough. Al clatters down the stairs, materializes panting in the kitchen.
"She's gone, isn't she?"
I whisper. He nods. I sink to my knees. The next day, Laura brings a morning bouquet to hang on the front door. It's round and black, with long streamers and artificial flowers pasted in the middle. Mother would have hated it. She didn't like fake flowers. And neither do I.
"It's to show the community that this is a house of mourning,"
Laura says when she sees me scowling. "I suspect they know that," I say. The wind blew so hard all night it swept most of the snow into the sea. Neighbors swoop toward the house like crows, in groups of two and three, black scarves and coats flapping. They rap on the front door, hang their coats on hooks in the foyer, file past Mother's body in the shell room. The women bustle into the kitchen. They know what to do in a situation like this. Exactly what they've always done. Here is Lisa Dubnoff, unwrapping a loaf of spice cake. Mary Violet Verzolino, slicing turkey. Annabelle Weinstein, washing dishes. The men jam their hands in their pockets, talk about the price of lobster, squint out at the horizon. I watch some of them out the kitchen window smoking cigarettes and pipes in the yard, stamping their feet and hunching their shoulders as they pass around a flask. These neighbors leech pity the way a canteen of cold water sweats in the heat. The slightest inquiry is freighted with words unsaid. Worried about you. Feel sorry for you. So glad I'm not you. The women in the kitchen stop talking as soon as I come in, but I hear their whispers. Lord help her, what will Christina do without her mother? I want to tell them, my mother hasn't actually been present for a long time. I'll get along fine. But there's no way to say this without sounding harsh. So I stay quiet. In the late afternoon of the third day, we huddle around Mother's burial plot in the family graveyard, strafed by the wind. The sky is yellow-gray as a caul. Reverend Carter from Cushing Baptist Church opens his Bible, clears his throat. When you live on a farm, he says, you are particularly aware that God's creatures are born naked and alone, given only a short time on this earth. Hungry, cold, persecuted, afflicted, released. Each one of us experiences moments of doubt, of despair, of feeling unduly burdened. But there is solace to be found in giving yourself to the Lord and accepting His blessings. The best we can do is appreciate the wonders of God's green earth, try to avoid calamity, and put our faith in Him. This sermon sums up Mother's life perhaps all too well, though it does little to improve the general mood. Before we leave the gravesite, Mary sings Mother's favorite gospel hymn, "Oh, what joy it will be when His face I behold, living gems at His feet to lay down. It would sweeten my bliss in the city of gold, should there be any stars in my crown." Mary's lovely voice rises and lingers in the air, and by the end of the song most of us are crying. I am too. Though I still don't know what those stars are meant to represent. My mistake, I suppose, is in thinking they should mean something. One morning in July, I'm sitting in my chair in the kitchen as usual, when there's a rap on the window. A slip of a girl with straight brown hair and large brown eyes is staring at me. The side door is open, as it always is in the summer. I nod at the doorway, and she comes to the threshold and steps cautiously inside. "Yes?"
"I'm hoping I might impose on you for a glass of water."
The girl is wearing a white shift dress, and her feet are bare. She is watchful, but clearly unafraid, as if accustomed to walking into the homes of strangers. "Help yourself," I tell her, motioning toward the hand pump in the pantry. She sidles across the room and disappears around the corner. From my chair I hear the screech of the heavy iron arm moving up and down, the chortle of water.
"Can I use this cup here?" she calls.
"Sure." She comes back around the corner, drinking noisily from a chipped white mug.
"That's better," she says, setting the cup on the counter. "I'm Betsy, staying up the road with my cousins for the summer. And you must be Christina."
I can't help smiling at her forthrightness.
"How did you know that?"
"They told me there's only one woman living in this house, and she's named Christina, so I figured."
Lolly, who's been winding around my feet, leaps into my lap. The girl strokes her under the chin until she purrs, then looks around at the other cats milling around the kitchen. It's time for their breakfast.
"You sure have a lot of cats."
"I do."
"Cats only like you because you feed them."
"That's not true." Lolly sinks down, exposing her belly to be rubbed.
"I'm guessing you don't have a cat."
"No."
"A dog?"
She nods.
"His name is Freckles."
"Mine is Topsy."
"Where is he?"
"Probably out in the field with my brother Al. He doesn't like cats much."
"The dog or your brother?"
I laugh.
"Both, I guess." "Well, that's no surprise. Boys don't like cats."
"Some do."
"Not many."
"You seem awfully sure of your opinions," I tell her.
"Well, I think about things a lot," she says. "I hope you won't mind my asking. What's wrong with you?"
I have spent my life bristling at this question. But the girl seems so frankly curious that I feel compelled to answer.
"The doctors don't know. When I was born, my bones were kind of deformed," she says. "I had to do all kinds of exercises to get better. I'm still a little crooked, see? Kids made fun of me."
She shrugs.
"You know."
I shrug back.
"I know."
The girl raises her chin at the pile on the sideboard.
"Look at that pile of dirty dishes. You could use some help."
She goes over to the sideboard, makes a pile of dishes, and carries them over to the long cast-iron sink in the pantry. And then, to my surprise, she washes them. When Papa dies at the age of 72 in 1935, he has been so unwell and so unhappy for so long that his death comes as a relief. For decades I did my best to care for this man who ended my schooling at 12, who squandered the family fortune, such that it was, on a crackpot scheme,
who expected his only daughter, possessed of an infirmity as debilitating as his own, to manage the household, and never once said thank you.